everybody to Breaking Kayfabe. I am your host, Jeff Baldwin. With me, my co-host, little known fact about my co-host, the personal masseuse to Robert Kraft. Barry, have you been in the Jupiter, Florida area lately?
Lately, I have not. I'm very, very familiar with Robert Kraft and his body, obviously. But no, I have not been to Jupiter or Uranus lately, Jeff. So,
is there anything sexier than the body of a 77-year-old man? I think not. On this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the sexual proclivities of Robert Kraft. We're going to break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, wrestling, pop culture, and other peculiarities coming out of the Jupiter, Florida area. Barry, are you ready to go, my friend?
We have an action-packed show today, Jeff, so I am absolutely ready. I have spent all morning watching this TV show, Cheaters, which has been playing on VH1, which is really, I don't know how this escaped me. This is an astounding show, this Cheaters show, but I need some sort of distraction now back to reality. So we should talk about professional wrestling, right?
Cheaters makes Maury Povich look classy. I'll just say that. So on today's show, we are going to be looking at another one of Barry's top 10 angles in CWF wrestling history. And we're going to take a special look at that. We are going to be looking at a match of the week, a newly debuting storyline here on Breaking Kayfabe, as we have reached out to three of the people on our message board, and we're going to do this every week. We give them a match of the week. They review it. Some of them gave us the nice shortened version of their thoughts. Some of us gave us the, oh, dare I say, Barry, Dr. Zhivago-esque length on the storyline review. We're also going to be looking at our movie of the week, a movie that I will proudly tell Barry Rose before we get into it, received a solid 26% on the Rotten Tomatoes site. All that plus, hey, Barry, how's this? We're going to have a special interview with Bob Roop. Been in the news a bit lately, has Mr. Roop?
Yeah, so Bob has been, I don't know if controversial is the correct term. I'm going to assume it is, but a video from 40 years ago that has been dubbed the Knoxville Five has resurfaced over the last couple of weeks. Bob has been a friend of our show. He's been on twice previously. Bob said, hey, I'd love to come on and talk about this video. This is a world exclusive. Other media outlets, nowhere near as professional as you and I, Jeff, and Sweet Lou Kippelman, our producer, they have reached out to Bob, and Bob said, I will only come on Breaking Kayfabe with Baldwin and Barry to discuss this. We are honored to have him.
Do you know what he said to those other podcasts out there? Jericho, you know, your other Arcadian sites. No. He said, no, I want to go to Breaking Kayfabe. Yeah, those are the two guys that I want to talk to about this controversial subject 40 years ago. And the controversy still exists, Barry. So before we do, we are going to be taking a look at, as I said, at one of the top 10 angles in championship wrestling from Florida history. Barry, you are the archivist. That's the word you like a little better, of CWF wrestling history. Why don't you tell the good folks about the angle that we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, absolutely, too. And just a slight correction with that, Jeff. This is the top 25 angles
correct me again.
Gotcha. Top 25 angles in the history of CWF. Quick backstory, which we talked about last week. We assembled a panel, and it was some 10 to 15 people I don't want to say experts, but experts on CWF, people that had watched it in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. It was a really varied panel, and we got together, and I said, give me your top 25 angles, and the 25 that received the most votes made it into the list, and the one we're going to talk about today is number 5. It is uno, dos, tres, cuatro, cinco. Cinco, and why do I say cinco?
Why
because
do you say
it's the
cinco?
Legend of El Santo, Jeff.
El Santo, the famous Mexican wrestler? He came to Florida?
Well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't, and we'll have to go through this. But anyways, this occurred some 38 years ago this past January. It was January 14th, 1981. Dusty Rhodes and El Santo, the Mexican legendary luchador El Santo, well, maybe not, which was really the assassin Jody Hamilton, who lost somewhere 40 or 50 pounds, appears on CWF TV to present a plaque and several Mexican souvenirs to Dusty Rhodes. Santo then slams Rhodes with the plaque, pulls off the mask, reveals himself as one of the most hated arch rivals of Dusty Rhodes. It's the assassin. And this was really an incredible angle for several reasons. First off, none of us expected. I'm not sure in 81 we knew who El Santo was from seeing him. I certainly the name is going to ring a bell, but I don't know if we had ever seen in 81 any El Santo matches. So I don't want to say that when I was watching this, I don't really remember, to be honest. Was I aware that something was going to go down? Yeah, there's always a really good chance. But at the same time, CWF was known for bringing on people, whether they were sports figures or local political figures, and they would present awards. You know, Dusty Rhodes or Gordon Solie or Eddie Graham, they were always getting some sort of award. So this could have been legitimate. Thank God it wasn't. Because Jody Hamilton comes out, pretends to not understand English. Of course, he's not really speaking Spanish. He would do single words like C, which was really funny. Gordon is talking to him very slowly and loudly at him, which is very odd that he's doing that. But I guess it's 1981, and Hamilton, again, is doing a lot of the head nodding and C. And Jody's giving him kind of this blank look, et cetera. So it's kind of cool. When they go for the plaque, Hamilton, Jody takes this, smashes him over the head, and the entire place just gets quiet. Because I think, again, everybody's a little stunned that this happens. And then Jody's standing over in perfect English. All of a sudden, he can speak perfect English, and he's saying, get him out of here, get this garbage out of here. It was really just an incredible, incredible angle because, A, it was unique. You know, you think about wrestling angles and you think about how they're recycled and you think about how they go territory to territory and they're done. We had never seen anything ever like that. And just to be clear on this as well, this was done prior to what Austin Idol did in Memphis. This was the original right here. So it was pretty incredible. What I like about this too, what I like about this angle is take out the realism of this angle. And maybe in hindsight, it's not as, though it's still an incredible angle to me, even to this day. But back in its day, this was the talk of the territory. And this was the assassin, the first time coming back to Florida in 4 years. Again, he looked completely different. I'm going to say he lost somewhere 50 or 60 pounds, so you really couldn't tell it was him. And it set the territory on fire. And they ran with this. They ran with the program between Dusty and the Assassin for the next 2 or 3 months, and really conceivably even longer than that because they kept throwing other people into it. So when we posted this, and we probably posted this in our group, I guess about 2 years ago, right around the same time we were doing the first CWF Legends Fan Fest, well, Jody Hamilton came into the group and he commented on that. And again, whether I'm the age I'm at now or in 20 years, you know, as I'm winding down, I'm in the ninth inning of life, it'll never be lost on me that somebody I grew up watching and was mesmerized by will interact with us through social media. So the fact that Jody Hamilton gave us his thoughts on this whole angle, and I'm going to read this to you, was just, you know, it's, I get giddy. I still, like, as I'm reading it now, I'm getting goosebumps. I still get giddy. But in Jody Hamilton's own words, and Dusty at this point had already passed away, which would have been great to at least get Dusty's view on this as well, but he had already passed. There were several things that made the angle a huge success that it was. First, I put a lot of time and thought into what I could make to make it a complete surprise. So many angles are really predictable, not quite as many back in those days as they are now. Second, I had not been to Florida to wrestle in quite some times, but the fans are smart and seldom fail to pick up on somebody no matter how much they attempt to change their character. He's right about that. Third was how to do it without speaking. Fans would have picked up on my voice right away had I talked, so I had to set up a scenario that didn't require me talking and letting the master, Gordon Solie, explain to everyone exactly why Dusty and El Santo were there. Fourth, to ensure that the fans did not recognize me, I literally trained my ass off by losing nearly 60 pounds. Fifth, I wanted to pick a person that I could make myself look a little bit alike, but whose name would not be familiar with wrestling fans just about everywhere. El Santo, one of, if not the biggest name in wrestling in Mexico, and who at times wore a silver mask, was perfect. After all that thought and planning, all that was left was to execute it without mistakes. And if I do say so myself, the execution of the entire angle was pretty much flawless. It must have been, because it's considered one of the top three angles of all time, and I'm proud to have been a part of it. I know it drew big houses all over Florida at a time when big houses were definitely not being drawn. I gotta tell ya, I really miss those days, and I'm saddened by what's being done to my beloved profession today. The people running wrestling have no respect for the business. They could care less what the fans want or like. The fans can take or leave their product. I agree with all this, by the way. And there isn't anything that's better out there, so the fans have nothing to choose from. So they watch what's out there or nothing at all. That's what's killing professional wrestling at a major league level. The major product on television isn't worth watching. It's garbage, and that isn't just sour grapes on my behalf either. That's reality. Everybody have a great day. So I just, you know, he's obviously not a fan of what's taking place currently in wrestling, and he's extremely vocal about that. But his thoughts on the angle and the fact that I think a lot of these angles, you know, we talked in our group a few weeks back about the Dusty Rhodes, where he shows up on TV and half of his face is paralyzed. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And that was done on the fly. Dusty had a root canal that morning, so he goes from his dentist getting a root canal and then goes to the TV studio, the Sportatorium, and they decide to work that into something and film an angle, which is very smart. At the same time, to read all the thought that went into the El Santo angle, and if he lost 60 pounds, as he says, and I believe that, you and I both know that doesn't happen overnight. So I'm going to assume he'd been planning this for months. Tremendous angle. It is number 5 on my list. I think it deserves to be number 5. If not even higher, it definitely deserves to be in that area. So,
well, I'll say this. I've pointed this out before, that Jody Hamilton and the Assassins, I believe Tom Ernesto was the other one, were the main event heels on the very first card I ever saw as a kid. And Jody Hamilton is one of those guys that, as the years have gone by, that time has forgotten as one of the truly effective heels in the history of the business. I mean to tell you, he could put some asses in the seats with his promos. He truly could terrify you just with the slow, very deep pacing of his voice and sinister ways that he would get an interview across. I'll tell you, as time went on with this angle, I happened to, this morning, I was scrolling through the old YouTube, and I came on the 106 North Albany page on YouTube has some great stuff. And there is a set of promos for a card in Miami Beach. I want to say this is August, so it's months after the angle. Okay. And they had done a bit where the Assassin was a claimant of the NWA world title, because at that point Dusty had won the world title. And so Jody is doing a promo for the card in Miami Beach where he's going to be facing Dusty for the NWA title. And he says something that just resonated with me, because this is, think about this being said today, Barry. Jody Hamilton, in doing his promo for the match in Miami, says, "Let me tell you something, Dusty Rhodes, I would rather die in the ring than have you beat me. I would die in the ring rather than have you." And I sat there and went, holy crap, that's such a good job, so effective on the promo. You know, I sit there and go, man, I'd go down and watch that card. I mean, besides the fact there were some other good matches on the card, but I'm going, wow, that makes this a hell of an interesting, compelling thing. And, you know, Dusty did a great babyface promo talking about how, you know, the Assassin had made up this claim that he's a claimant for the NWA title, but it was so effective. Now think about it. This means that this angle had been carrying on for the better part of 7 months in a small territory. I won't say a small territory, but a single state territory like Florida. For 7 months, they kept people coming back to that match, you know, and I just think it's amazing how effective that Jody Hamilton was in this role, this, you know, creating this angle as El Santo, and it's just super, super stuff. there's no question about it. He was amazing.
Yeah, it's you know, you're 100% correct in everything that you just said. So they had this rocking feud in 1976, and it really started when Jody was the booker, and you know, Dusty was the top babyface. Jody became the booker. Jody brought in his brother, the Missouri Mauler, brought in Rock Hunter, who was a very, very good friend of theirs from Georgia, and they brought in, you know, Pac Song came in, some other guys as well, but the main focus really was Jody or the Mauler versus Dusty Rhodes. And there was such a history between Rhodes and the Assassin. And the angle, when the feud was done and it was all wrapped up, Jody actually turned babyface in late 76 and then spent the first 3 months or so of 77 teaming with Dusty to go against superstar Billy Graham and Ox Baker. He left the state kind of inexplicably, moved on to another territory, and I think the booker then became Tom Renesto, who was his old partner as the Assassins. But, you know, part of it was when he returned was he was very angry that Dusty had worn an Assassin mask. And he said, you know, you've insulted the Assassins, you know, and he was so his interviews. And you just said about, you know, about to death and killing and all that stuff you could never get away with right now and probably shouldn't get away with. But back then when you saw it, it was so believable. That was what the key was. As you're watching this, you believe this. Here's a guy wearing a yellow mask, calling himself the Assassin, but you believe it. You know, in hindsight, maybe it's a little ridiculous. Back then, just the opposite. It was believable, and it was scary. And Jody Hamilton was so instrumental in the development of so many guys when he was with WCW. You know, he was such a big deal. A lot of people view him as a mentor. They just, you know, they can't say enough good about Jody. He took over developmental territory for the WWE, had a falling out with Vince. There were lawsuits involved, and he's out of professional wrestling. And it's a shame. He's 80 years old at this point, still sharp as a tack. Jeff, you met him 2 years ago. We had some great conversations. He is still, could still cut a promo. It's a guy that could, at this date, you could utilize him. He certainly, you know, he doesn't look like he looked 40 years ago and 30 years ago. That being said, vocally, he's still eerie. I think he could offer a lot to professional wrestling. Sadly, nobody wants him.
Well, and the one key thing, I'll say it again, that you could say about Jody Hamilton is that when he said something in an interview, you believed him. No matter how crazy, you know, like I will stay in the ring till I die. You believed that Jody Hamilton was telling you the truth. This wasn't some guy that was doing some goofy promo or becoming a – he was not a cartoon. He was a guy that was menacing who happened to be wearing a mask. And he put the chills up your spine when he said, you know, he said some of the things that he would say on promos, a completely forgotten guy in wrestling history, I believe, when it comes to – you know, you talk about the top – 3, 4, 5 promos of all time. And Jody Hamilton was money in the bank with his promos. I'll tell you that. So I'll tell you about two other guys that are money in the bank, Barry, and that is Ricky Steamboat and Jimmy Snuka. We are going to now go to our very first match of the week, and it is taking us to June 3rd, 1981. But we're not going to be in Mid-Atlantic, Barry, because we are going to Japan. And they both happen to be wrestling for Giant Baba's All Japan Pro Wrestling. And they put them in the ring together. And they had a match. Barry, you've had a chance to watch. I believe you watched it this morning. Tell me what you thought of this match.
Yeah, and I want to give you 4 stars for that segue, because that was about as smooth as silk right there. That was like Greek yogurt that's been filtered 4,000 times, Jeff. Smooth as could possibly be. Props to you, sir. I saw this match today, and I really liked it. And I think we need to be clear about this too, because whenever we watch the matches, I would say a solid 14 out of 15 times, I love these matches and I rave about them. And let's be honest, we're not choosing matches that we think we're going to hate. I mean, the idea is you want to choose a match that you feel is very good. You have actually chosen matches previously and then messaged me and said, you know what, I don't think it's good enough, and I don't think we should talk about it. And I back you on that. So, but this match is really, really great. And this is Steamboat looks, so we've raved about Steamboat in the internet. The entire wrestling world has raved about Steamboat for, you know, the last 40 years, and he deserves everything he gets. But am I crazy, or does Steamboat even go the little extra distance for this match? I mean, which is odd to say, because didn't Steamboat go the distance every match? He is unbelievable. Jimmy Snuka. So I've seen Jimmy Snuka as a heel. Certainly he was national when he was on TBS teaming with Terry Gordy. And then, you know, I've seen stuff in the Mid-Atlantic area. But this Jimmy Snuka here was even crazier. He's sneering, cocks his head, making these odd facial expressions. And, you know, I don't know if he was if he had some sort of enhancer during this match or prior to this match. But my God, is he everywhere? He's flipping over ropes constantly. He's putting his body at risk. You know, he's doing backflips kind of over the top rope.
Barry, are you saying, let me just interrupt you for a second, that in order to take those bumps, you might have taken a bump?
Wow, you're on a roll today, Jeff.
Boom!
You're on a roll. Yeah, so something, because, you know, we've all seen Jimmy Snuka, and when Jimmy Snuka had his working boots on, and he is wearing boots for this match, he's as good as anybody, especially as a heel. But my God, he's, you know, you talked to Adrian Adonis last week, and I love the analogy of the human pinball machine, because that's what Snuka was this week. He's just, with zero regard to his body, he's just flying, flipping, and just going everywhere. And it really makes for a spectacular match. This is my favorite Snuka by far. Steamboat selling. So look, I'm not going to break any new ground here. Steamboat is maybe the best seller in the history of professional wrestling. As good as he has, as we've seen him on a national basis, his selling here, Jeff, may even exceed what we ever saw with the Flair Steamboat matches. He's that good. They do a spot. And Steamboat bleeds in this match too, which I think adds credibility to it. Snuka does this spot. He's coming back into the ring, and he jumps on the top rope, completely botches, and falls to the mat. And Steamboat recovers. They just go out of control. Now, you and I talked off air earlier, and you really hated the ending. And I think some of the people that reviewed really hated it. I hated the ending. To the point of, or I should say, I hated the ending with the fact of that it you didn't get a decisive finish for the match. There wasn't a clear-cut winner. But at the same time, I liked how out of control and chaotic it was. And the fact that, you know, they're outside the ring and they're still brawling, it becomes this whole schmoz. And I just thought, you know, I thought this is professional wrestling right here. This is the shit that we want to see. And it's very different. You know, I rave about NXT all the time, which is a completely different product. But this was great. And this Jimmy Snuka, for whatever reason, you know, WWE brought him in as a heel, but they brought him in as kind of this simple, almost childlike, savage type of heel. That was controlled, you know, by his manager, Lou Albano. But at the same time, they should have brought in this maniac. That's what this guy was. This guy's a fucking maniac in Japan. And this, to me, is good stuff, Jeff.
So this Jimmy Snuka, this just popped into my mind. This Jimmy Snuka is like a Joe LeDuc maniac.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he really is. He's like an animal in there. He's not the subdued heel who, you know, it just happens to be managed by Lou Albano. I mean, you know, not that he didn't ever have some heelish tendencies and get put over strong as a heel, but he just seems so subdued when he got to the WWF compared to this guy who, you know, of course, naturally he and Steamboat had worked together in Mid-Atlantic for a few years. So they knew each other. It was probably like two old dance partners. But yeah, no, this is some great stuff. This is easily a solid 4.5+ match. And the only reason I would drop it maybe a quarter of a star down to a solid 4.5, because it could have been higher, is I was disappointed in the way they finished it, because in the end, Steamboat gets Snuka hooked up in the ropes and starts choking him, and they go in, you know, they're singing the Ring Boys to break up the match. Steamboat throws him off. Then he throws the referee, gets disqualified, which, I mean, how many times have we seen Ricky Steamboat get disqualified, for God's sakes? But, you know, he's choking Snuka, won't let him up. And, you know, it big schmoz, like you said at the end. But it was really, really good stuff. The stuff that happens before the ending, which is not so good, is just really amazing stuff. So here's what we're going to do, Barry. We are going to go to our three-person panel that we have selected to talk about this match. We are going to, let me see here, Kevin Carter. We are going to Matthew Corcoran. And I believe Chris Spiker was the last one, Barry.
Chris Spiker, our boy.
Yeah, Philadelphia native. So anyway, so here's what Matthew Carter had to say. I'm sorry, Kevin Carter. And Kevin wrote quite the long summary. Thank you, Kevin. Kevin says, first and foremost, I want to thank Jeff and Barry for the opportunity to review something for the Brothership. First thing I noticed is that Snuka was in boots as the entrants were being done. I thought Steamboat looked in great shape until Snuka took off his jacket. The guy was menacing big. Once the match started, lots of back and forth action, really good 80s wrestling here. A few of the famous Steamboat deep arm drags, as always, perfection. But Snuka takes him like $1 million. Match was pretty smooth up until the 6:17 mark. Boy, I'm telling you, Mr. Carter, you are really paying attention. You're keeping your time checks there. Snuka takes a tackle, tries to kip up, and doesn't quite make it. I think the spot falling was supposed to be Snuka giving Steamboat a backdrop, but the timing is off, so Steamboat, making chicken salad out of chicken crap, turns it into an ugly leapfrog. Then Snuka leapfrogs Steamboat, and Steamboat hits a crossbody to get the match back on track. Accidents happen, but these two ended up tossing the hell out of or making the hell out of a miscue. Steamboat's leaping ability is unreal as he springs up from what appears to be zero effort and just hangs in there. Let me skip forward here as Kevin. Steamboat ends up shoving the ref a couple times, gets DQ'd after the big chop to the ref's head at 21:52. Snuka is still in the tree of woe. Steamboat is pretty vicious here as he keeps going back to the attack on Snuka several times after being pulled off. Ricky going off on the ref and a few of the boys at ringside. Snuka makes a nice escape from the ring, only to get attacked again by Steamboat. The Dragon is really showing some fire. I've never seen Steamboat so relentless. Fun match. I was stunned by the athletic ability of both men, Snuka especially. I really enjoyed the match a lot. Thank you very much, Kevin. So, Barry, which one are you going to take next?
I'm going to take our old buddy Chris Spiker. He has a love for donuts like I do, so that seems like that would make a lot of sense.
And women that Chris... hang out at donut shops. I'll just say that.
Well, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. That's for sure. So Chris Spiker. So admittedly, I wasn't familiar with Jimmy Snuka's work prior to 1983. Normally, ignorance is bliss, but thanks to Jeff, All Elite Booker Baudrin, and Barry Historian Rose, I'm never going to live that one down, obviously.
Truly.
I viewed this match from All Japan in 1981 and was totally impressed. Steamboat is a wrestling god, so I knew this would be good. It was quite good. I enjoyed the slow but brutal work from both men. Snuka was so methodical that it was awesome. He looks weird wearing boots, though. The match was worked at a slightly slower pace, but didn't feel like it. I cheered when Steamboat hit a top rope splash on Snuka. The end, when Steamboat goes off on him, though, is superb. I wish we had gotten more of that dragon in the late 80s. Instead, we get him being a family man. Fuck you, Bonnie Steamboat. I loved how he just went off chopping everyone. There's a T-shirt and a lawsuit right there, all rolled into one.
Exactly.
I loved how he just went off chopping everyone. I just wish it had been better resolution or more footage if they had a rematch or a feud. So he enjoyed it.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, I'm going to go Matthew Corcoran. Thank you for your review, Matthew. Matthew says, when I saw this was the match I would be watching, I was pretty excited. I am a Steamboat fan, and embarrassingly enough, I do not think I've ever seen a match prior to his bout against Matt Bourne at WrestleMania 1. Okay, first of all, let's just stop there. Matthew, you're a Steamboat fan, and you've never seen anything before. Fucking 1985? Because certainly, Barry, there's nothing available out there. Okay, I'm done. So, watching some of his old Mid-Atlantic work is on my list of things to do, but like the majority of that list, I will probably get to it tomorrow. Snuka was a guy I liked okay, but I truthfully can't recall a standout match. Hold on one second. Matthew. Okay, I'll go back. Not that he didn't have them. I just only seen his WWF stuff. As far as the fact that he seemed like a real piece of trash. Oh, there's another shirt. I will put that aside and write on what this match was. And it was good with some flashes of great. The match starts with Snuka pacing and sneering. He looks like a five-star heel with the head cocking, menacing look and goatee. I dug this, new to me, Snuka. Steamboat is his usual babyface self, waving to the crowd and playing the part of the gracious guest. This is one of the things I always thought made him a great psychologist. He shows no sense of killer instinct, does not give the impression that he's looking to inflict any pain. He seems like a guy who's ready for an athletic exhibition, and when that comes back up later, it's great. Oh, and by the way, these guys look like Swayze doing Tai Chi in the mist. Good. There you go. That was for you, Barry. If either of them ever looked better physically, I don't know when it was. Rather than give you a breakdown of the whole match, I will add a few thoughts. The pacing was great. Steamboat's deep arm drag is a thing of beauty, and I really enjoyed seeing the headlock by the home base of the contest. Even when Steamboat had it locked in, he would take the time to wrench it. Because this is a sporting competition, I also thought seeing Steamboat botch a leapfrog and Snuka eat it trying to springboard in the ring added realism to the match. If you watch any other professional sports, you will see momentum lead to a player slipping when running out of bounds or having to leap over the scorer's table. Not to gripe about today's product too much, but it is the choreographed routines or the moves that have no place being based in realism that lead to awkward botches. A stumble in the ropes from coming across too hot on a leapfrog seems plausible to me. Once again, I hope you're not expecting the WWE product to be plausible, but I digress. There was lots of great momentum and finesse spots that led to both wrestlers getting knocked out of the ring at certain points, and they all looked great. My favorite part of this match, which I was alluding to earlier, was when Steamboat was outside and placed his hand on the mat to begin climbing in the ring. Snuka planted his foot down and stomped on his hand. It looked real, and Steamboat sold it perfectly. He paced the ring with pain, giving way to anger, the same way you motherfucker the corner table when you catch your toe on the leg of it. Haven't we all been there, Barry? After the moment, Steamboat went from being the gracious athlete to the pissed off wrestler. And from then on, he wrestled with an aggressive style that he did not have in the first part of the match. This is what made Steamboat one of the best ever. He completely changed his style mid-match to advance the narrative and made Snuka look great going along with it. So hold on, let's just stop there. Because, boy, that's a really good point, Barry. You know, that Steamboat had the ability to do that, to seemingly become a different wrestler mid-match. And that's something you got to give Steamboat a lot of credit for, Barry.
Oh, no, absolutely. Steamboat is... this is a different side of Steamboat, though. He's doing this pile driver. What about that pile driver he did as well? This is a different guy. And I don't know if I've ever seen Steamboat and Snuka have matches like this before. I'm not even talking about against each other. I just mean in general, this is a different side, I think, for both of them.
Yeah, and I have to say, I think if this rookie Steamboat, the one you saw in the second part of this match, had showed up more often, I think he would have been a huger deal in Japan, because part of the reason that he wasn't such a big deal and why his run as world champion didn't get over in 1989 is because, let's face it, Ricky Steamboat's greatest attribute is making his opponent look good. And in Japan, they want you to go out there and beat the hell out of guys, because that's how Hansen and Brody and guys like that got over. Anyway, just to finish off the review, overall, I really enjoyed this match. It had the feel of a true athletic fight. Snuka was a great heel and worked with an attitude that made him look strong without having to use the crowd to get heat. Steamboat was also great, and from what I can gather, part Wolverine in his ability to heal from a cut. This match had a great, strong, fast pace, and they knew exactly when to bring it back to the center of the ring with mat wrestling to build up to the next crescendo. I did not love the finish, as I thought that even with Steamboat finding his true inner aggression, it did not seem to completely fit. The match sold me on going back into the archives and watching some of the other matches these guys had from the area. Thanks for letting us play at home. This was fun. So we want to thank Matthew and the other two people for their reviews. Good stuff, Barry, on our very first match of the week.
Yeah, some really good insights, too. And that's one thing. Since we've been doing the movie reviews and this being our first match of the week that we have guest reviewers for, people aren't just half-assing this. If anything, they are jumping in and delivering and over-exceeding our expectations by far. So just a fantastic job. And I think we're going to see that as we transition to the movie review, Jeff, which is nowhere near as smooth as the segue that you just did.
Well, I was going to say, speaking of not meeting certain expectations, we'll take a look at Barry's movie of the week. And we have three people that have graciously reviewed the movie for us. So, Barry, why don't you tell the good folks about your movie of the week? I will offer my thoughts, and then we'll read our three reviews.
Yeah, that's why your name comes first too in the podcast, Jeff, because there's a reason. So yeah, there's a reason for it. So, you know, one of the things that I love about our Facebook group too, I posted something maybe a month ago, Jeff, maybe 3 weeks ago, and it was a review of a movie. It was commentary of a movie called Atomic Blonde with Charlize Theron and James McAvoy. And James McAvoy, first off, what a tremendous actor, just underrated. But when I posted I was watching this movie and how this movie had escaped me, two people jumped in, one being our old buddy, and when I say old, I mean it, Greg Good, and the other being Corey McMillan, and they said, have you ever seen Polar? It's kind of it's got a similar vibe. It's maybe John Wick light. It's a Netflix original. I said, no, but I definitely have to watch it. Well, I went and I watched it, and I really enjoyed it. And certainly there are some flaws, and I think you're going to see it in the reviews. And you mentioned at the top of the show, I hadn't even seen this. You said Rotten Tomatoes was like 28%. Is that correct? Or 26. IMDb was 28%?
Well, actually, IMDb, I think, gave it like a 6.3, which isn't a bad score. But Rotten Tomatoes, okay. Yeah, solid 26%, Barry.
Yeah, now, there are definite flaws with the movie. I will say the first 20 to 30 minutes of the movie moves very slow. I do like the fact there is a murder, which is the first scene, and I enjoyed that. And then it drags a little bit, and then it gets into the meat of the movie. And I really enjoyed it. Look, this is not John Wick or Atomic Blonde. That being said, this is, as you like to say, Jeff, this is a popcorn movie. This is a movie I think you can sit down. Doesn't require you to do a lot of thinking. There's not a lot of deep thought that's going to go on here. But at the end of the day, you're going to be entertained. Are there flaws with this movie? There are. There are some that are glaring, which I will talk about right now briefly. One is once you get past that beginning, that first 20 or 25 minutes, I found myself going, I mean, if this is how it's going to be, I may have to bail. And then all of a sudden something happens and then the movie's absolutely fine. It stays with that. The ending, and I'm not going to tell you, but I just thought the ending was a little flat. It just, what a great buildup. And then it's like, yeah, there it is. The acting, Vanessa Hudgens, who, if you would have asked me 5 or 6 years ago, and I don't know if she was a good actress or not, I can't tell you, but I can tell you she's stunningly beautiful. I wasn't even sure this was Vanessa Hudgens in this movie, and I had to Google to see who the actress was because the movie is accomplished making her not really attractive. Which it really says something. That being said, her acting is not great in this movie. The other character, which you and I talked about off air as we had a conversation about this movie, it's the character who is, I think, is it Blood?
Blute.
What? Blute, okay. He is a heavyset blonde guy with the Mikhail Gorbachev birthmark on his face. And he's a cartoon character, and I think I equated it today when we were talking that he would have fit in perfectly with the 1960s version, the Adam West version of Batman. He's an over-the-top villain, and it's almost cartoonish and comical. Part of the criticism of this movie, not just from our reviewers, which I don't think they get too heavy into it, but from a lot of people has been that it's over-the-top violence. It's almost torture porn. And to that end, there is a torture scene in this movie, which is very graphic and lasts several minutes, and it's brutal to watch, but it works within the context of the movie. I don't think, unlike a movie like Hostel, which was, or Green Inferno, Jeff, which I'm assuming you've seen neither of those movies.
Correct, by the way.
Yeah, and look, you know, I've seen both those movies numerous times. You know, it's torture porn to the point that it doesn't always mean a whole lot to the storyline. It's like, how much torture can we show you with people being tortured and screaming? And it becomes very, very scary in some ways. I'm not a huge fan, though. I did like the Green Inferno, actually. But this is different because this is really really important to the storyline. At least I thought that it was, and it's very unsettling at the same time. So if I was rating this movie on a scale of 1 to 5, I would probably go a solid 3. It's not a movie that I think I'm going to watch on repeat viewing. It's not like a Roadhouse to me or a Fletch or something like that. But am I glad I saw it? I am glad I saw it. I think the lead actor, and what's his name, Jeff? Because I know I would butcher it if I said
his name is Mads Mikkelsen. And for the uninitiated, Mads Mikkelsen was the lead heel character in Daniel Craig's first stint as James Bond in Casino Royale. He's the guy that would had blood coming out of his tear ducts. And he was very effective in that role. And I've seen him in some other things, and I've really enjoyed him as an actor. He's a really good actor.
Yeah, he's a really good actor, too. And I think partly there was some people that were critical of his acting, but I think the character was supposed to be like that. And Sweet Lou Kippelman checking in, he also portrayed Hannibal Lecter on the TV show, which I think was it Hannibal was the TV show?
I think that's what it was called, yeah.
Yeah, he's a good actor. He's understated. I mean, you know, again, part of the beginning of the movie is he appears almost to be drugged, which, you know, I think he's obviously got some sort of PTSD, PTSD, whatever it's called, post-traumatic stress disorder. So he's got something going on where he's an assassin that is retired, and he's not a happy guy. You know, he's very sullen, very depressed, but his character, I think it works. I think it absolutely is supposed to be. I think partly, and you made a great point earlier, which I'm going to, you know, hand you this ball and let you go with it, is there are certain characters in this movie which are over the top and they're almost comical instead of being truly fearsome. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So let me just give the quick plot summary. Mads Mikkelsen plays Duncan Vizsla, who is the world's top assassin, who is set to retire. And he works for this corporation that hires him out for different jobs. And they have a much like All Japan Women, they have a mandatory retirement date, except it's not 25, it's 50. And he's due to retire. He's got a huge sum of money coming to him on the date of his retirement from this corporation. And the corporation decides, rather than pay him that huge sum of money that he's due, they're going to rub him out, because then the money will come back to the corporation, and it's a way of the corporation saving some money. So besides Mads Mikkelsen and the aforementioned Vanessa Hudgens, let me just point out a couple other people that are in the movie. There is a cameo by an almost unrecognizable Richard Dreyfuss. Did you notice Richard Dreyfuss there?
Yeah. So much like that, I was like, God, that looks like Richard Dreyfuss. And I Googled it. It's Richard Dreyfuss. Holy yes. Shit.
So there's an actress named Catherine Winnick, who, for those of you who are fans of the show Vikings, she was, I believe, the wife of the lead character, had a run of about 4 or 5 series. Barringer, there's also a wrestling angle to this. Why don't you tell the folks about who the wrestling star is that's in this movie? And no, it's not Dave Bautista.
Yeah, too. So as I'm watching, I'm going, who's this guy? He's big. I think his real name is Robert Mallet, but he was a guy who played Kurgan, right?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's our little wrestling angle. But so anyway, as Barry said, there are parts of this movie that I think are very effective, and there are parts of this movie that I think completely fall flat. The over the top violence, and this is, you know, when we review these movies, afterwards, my sister and mom have watched a few of the movies that we've reviewed, Streetwise and some other things that we've recommended as being very good movies. But this is not a movie that I'm going to recommend to my sister and my mom, because, again, the torture scene, which goes on seemingly just very, very long, and it's very graphic. And, you know, it's just like how it's almost like grueling to watch. And, you know, that's I told you when we were talking earlier today, that was the part of the movie where I was like, okay, I'm about ready to tap out on this movie here, but I kept going. So, but there are parts, first of all, and this is not a saving grace to the movie, and I'll offer my critical evaluation at the end here, but the movie is shot really nicely. Some of the scenes that I think the movie was filmed up in Canada, and the town that he lives in is absolutely beautiful. And the house that he has that no one knows about until the end of the movie, and they come to get him. But it's a beautiful, beautiful shot movie. But then there are these parts of the movie where there's violence, and you get like a sort of the point of view shot, and where the camera, you know, when someone gets knifed or slashed, they do the quick rush scene where you get the graphic close up of like someone getting their knife, a knife to the throat, or someone getting a bullet to the head. And that's just like it's something that's real popular in certain movies. Now, this movie was based on a graphic novel of the same name. So, maybe that accounts for the over the top violence. But you're correct. There's a group of five assassins that go after him. That Kurgan, the above mentioned Robert Mallet, is in. And to me, this group of five assassins, they are very similar, you mentioned this, to like some of the guys you would see in a Batman movie, like the henchmen. You know, you knew that these five people were going to meet an untimely demise at the hands of Mads Mikkelsen. And it's not a huge shock when they do. But there were parts of this movie that I sit there and found myself, you know, there's a scene where he's having a conversation with Vanessa Hudgens, and I'm going, okay, this is a nice little scene. It's very quiet. The acting, they're doing good, you know, but they're not enough of that. So I really cannot recommend this movie. I would say on a scale of 1 to 10, using the IMDb scale, IMDb gave it a 6.3, and I actually think that's a little high. I'm going, I'll say 5, 5.5-ish, because again, I really do like Mads Mikkelsen. He's a really good actor. The scene with Richard Dreyfuss comes out of nowhere, and that's kind of a really effective scene. But overall, because of the level of violence that, quite frankly, is a little, I don't want to say troubling, but if you're not a fan of that, and there's, like you say, Barry, you're into that kind of stuff, but for people that are not, they're going to sit there and go, ooh, yeah, no, this is not good. So, Barry, why don't we get to our movie reviewers for this week? So since it's your movie, why don't you tell the folks, take the first review and the third, I'll do the middle one, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, absolutely, too. We got some stellar reviews here. Our girl in Japan, Ashley Kamik, Ryan Damon, and as I'm scrolling down, Tom Hale. So these are some serious reviews. I am going to take Ashley's review because, A, it's the shortest. Knowing me, Jeff, you know I'm going to go that route. So I'm going to start off with Ashley. And what I like about this review, too, is that she absolutely fucking hates the movie. And I like that. I like people that have strong opinions about things, whether positive or negative. And Ashley Kamik, an hour and a half of my life I'll never get back. I honestly considered phoning it in after the first 20 minutes. And see, I can get that, because that first 20 minutes, that is painful. It was great to see Jackass guy get killed. The opening scene, and this is a spoiler, Johnny Knoxville gets killed. He would hence be Jackass guy. The sex and nudity are a lame attempt to make you not notice how shitty this movie is. I don't think that's ever a lame attempt when there's sex and nudity in a movie. That's just my opinion. The acting could it get any worse? I thought him teaching the kids was pretty funny. That is a great scene, by the way. And that scene, just, you know, because I guess we need to explain that, he goes into a classroom and teaches kids about the only thing he knows, which is how to kill people. And he's talking about how you do it with a knife and all this, and the teachers just watching this and just, you know, freaking out. So,
and the kids are very into it, by the way.
The kids were totally into it, which made it great. He did such a good job hiding where he's living, but then he leaves such a clear trail with his bank account. Seriously? She's right about that. I can't fight that one. Sometime shortly after writing the above comment, I fell asleep. So that's where the movie ends for me. So really, it's safe to say she fucking hated this movie with a clear passion. You know what? You know, everybody's different.
Well, let's just say, based on some photos that I saw that Ashley posted today, she appears to be going through the flu. She's had a cough. Yeah. So maybe the fact she fell asleep is because she wasn't feeling good. We'll give your movie that much. So maybe it wasn't the movie. It was maybe that poor Ashley was sick. So I'm going to read a review by Tom Hale. Tom says, holy Toledo, Batman. This is not your grandpa's Superman serial that they would show before movies back in the golden era of Hollywood at your local United Artists Theater in Mulberry, USA. The best way to explain this movie to someone who has never seen it would be a hodgepodge of various action and cult flicks rolled into one while on a hot dose of Monster Energy drink. So before going into this, I saw the internet saying everything about this movie is, quote, severe. That's, by the way, it's also true, Barry, under the violence, sex, both categories, severe. Now, mind you, I've seen most of the Italian gore films and films like Happiness, so I had my doubts, but boy, did they go away in a hurry. We start off in the country of Chile at a huge mansion on the hill and a retired hitman played by Johnny Knoxville enjoying retirement and lots of cocaine. And who would have thought? In the midst of his debauchery, he's taken out by a group of mercenaries, a la Kill Bill. I thought this was a revenge killing for one of his old targets until one of the mercenaries said, "None of us will get out alive." The credits rolls, and we meet Duncan, the Black Kaiser, who's played by Mads Mikkelsen, who reminded me of Dirty Harry, another hitman who was getting ready to retire as he's turning 50, and the company he works for has a forced retirement. He goes to a CPA, and they figure out how much money he's going to be getting into his account from a pension, which is $8 million that he will receive on his 50th birthday. So he's asked to do one more job, which he refuses at first, then takes it, but as a setup, as the company Duncan works for is using a loophole in their contract that states if the employee dies before his 50th birthday, the company keeps all the money. So the employee gets to keep all the money the employer has put into the pensions. The head of the company is Mr. Blute, who's played very scummy by Matt Lucas. Now, you know, by the way, I went and looked up Matt Lucas's other roles. Apparently, this guy has been very well received in other roles. Not so much in this one. Now, I need to take a moment and talk about the character. Disgusting, perverted, twisted, evil, obnoxious. Makes you want to vomit just by looking at him. I don't think we've seen a more vile villain since Baron Vladimir Harkonnen from Dune and Butterball Cinnabot from Hellraiser, which, by the way, I also didn't see. Now, I won't say much more and give the movie away, so here are my thoughts. Number one, despite the gritty overtones of the film, this film is brilliantly shot with vivid colors, with scenery shots that are awe-inspiring. Two, it is a classic hitman trying to retire but gets screwed and goes for a revenge story. Excuse me. The violence, number three, is beyond over the top, but it's not the blood that gets you, but the graphic way people would meet their demise. I had to watch this movie in blocks of 25 minutes because the violence was so severe. Just think about the final act in Taxi Driver when Robert De Niro foobars the pimps, but 2 hours long, and you get what I'm trying to convey. Overall, I would give this film 6 out of 10 stars, with the over-the-top violence ruining what was an entertaining film. I compare this to CZW and other outlaw wrestling mud shows. The violence is nonstop, and it just turns you off from enjoying the action. Would I recommend this to family and friends? Probably not, unless they're into this kind of movie. This is probably a one-time viewing of the film for me, but I do appreciate the opportunity to watch and review it. Thank you, Tom Hale. Okay, Barry, you take the final one.
So that's really interesting, and you and I kind of have a rule is that we don't read these reviews prior to either watching the movie or watching the match. And Tom Hale and I think I just agreed with a lot, and I didn't agree with everything, but a lot of what he said, we gave it the same rating. He's 6 out of 10. I'm 3 out of 5. So really interesting. So I'm going to take Ryan Damon. Ryan Damon.
That's good because that's the last one.
Yeah, exactly. And Ryan has got, I think this is somewhere in around 30,000 words. I say that. This is honestly, if I was in college and I needed a paper written right now, and I would go to Ryan and say, Ryan, can you write? Because this is as well-written, concise as anything I've ever seen in my life. He has done a great job. That being said, we have a limited time here, so I –
will you be reviewing the entire review?
I'm reviewing his review right now, and then somebody will be reviewing our podcast on Tuesday of me exactly, which is like this whole fucking twisted circle. So, as Lou Kippelman says, 8,000 words, concise. He doesn't leave any stone unturned here. I am, unfortunately, based off of time, going to have to leave a few of these stones unturned, but. I will admit that I am more of a television person. The ability to have character development, take episode by episode, is better to me than seeing a complete story beginning to end in 2 hours. This movie, to me, shows the great ability of Netflix to give freedom, but I think there is something to be said for the old system of movie development and also the movie-going experience. I'm not sure that the movie would have been made in the old system, and I don't know if anybody would be willing to see this movie with a group of their peers. I'd have to agree with that. So he's going through the what the plot of the movie is, which I will just kind of flip through this.
We've read in the other reviews, Barry.
Yeah, so I don't want to say, but. But I like his thoughts, though. A good concept and premise, if you don't try to think too hard about it, any amount of logic used will ruin it. The idea of the crew was was willing to kill him is very strange. They are in the same financial deal as him. They will be the ones being killed like this in the years to come if they survive at all. No explanation on this and how much they were being paid. In the opening scene, they murder somebody else, Johnny Knoxville. Knoxville's character being killed was probably the high point of the movie for me. There are about three or four scenes involving birds. So this is like the Korean director. What's his name with the pigeons?
John Woo with the doves.
With the doves, right, exactly. Yeah. The opening scene almost had me shutting the movie off with a terrible, god-awful, obviously fake bird done in CGI flying across the screen. The girl stares at an owl in the woods, and it is so cringeworthy. It flies away, and you can see that there was never any bird there at all. The final shooting scene also involved another set of CGI birds flying away before they reveal that she didn't kill him to end the movie. The birds take you out of the movie-going experience every time they show up. If this was a theater movie, I'm probably not the only one who would be running out the door asking for a refund. So Ryan Damon, clearly not a fan of CGI or birds in this movie whatsoever. There was so much blood and violence that any fan of the genre would be satisfied. The torture scenes were so bloody and excruciating to watch. Blute tortures him while listening to Roddy Piper's theme song. Is that accurate? Was that true?
Yeah, it was some sort of Scottish dirge.
Yeah. And he plays it and this whole torture scene, we got to say too, takes place, what, over 3 days, right? Going
exactly
into the fourth day. And he plays the same song. So there is somewhat of a connection to professional wrestling here. So I guess there are two connections.
That's true.
I think he could have played Stone Cold's theme song when he was escaping and killing all of Blute's unnamed foot soldiers. It might have been the highlight of the movie, with him breaking their legs and getting them to shoot each other, shooting two with one bullet, and just pistol whipping the final survivor to death. Also, there is enough sex and nudity that it should quench the thirst of the blood, guts, and boob demographic they were going for. Yes, it did. I can
Barry,
I'll be the spokesman for that.
There is plenty of sex and nudity, and there is one, I will dare say, fairly graphic sex scene involving Mads Mikkelsen going to town, and the young lady that he's going to town with, Flagaranto, what do you call it, Delectico, they are going to town on one another, and it's just, that portion of the movie, I could say that was pretty enjoyable stuff.
Yeah, and she has a great line, too, that she says twice in the movie when she's fooling around with these guys. She looks at them and goes, "It's blow time." And I just thought that was really funny. And there's a reason she says and does that, because that's the setup for the murders. So I thought that was pretty cool. I've only seen Mads Mikkelsen in this movie and Rogue One, a Star Wars movie. So that's interesting. He's a Star Wars guy as well. In Rogue One, he plays a troubled scientist who doesn't speak much. In this, he also plays a troubled soul as a retiring assassin who doesn't speak much. I might have not seen enough of his films to judge him, but he seems to be a one-trick pony. He seems to be a good character actor, but asked to be the lead in the movie, and he didn't impress. Vanessa Hudgens was the highlight of the movie as a friend, and I disagree with that because I thought she was terrible. Hey, Jeff, I'm going to completely derail this for 1 second. Talking about great character actors, Bertram Gilliam, familiar with Bertram Gilliam?
Mm-hmm.
He was in the whole fart scene in Blazing Saddles. And then was one of the guys in
Flesh. Is he the guy that died the other day?
Changing. What'd you say?
Was he the guy that died the other day?
No. He's actually very much alive. He's appearing about 20 minutes from me tonight in a one-man show, and I'm actually thinking about getting in the car and going. But he's a great actor, great character actor, and was in Fletch. He was the guy with the Fetzer valve when they're fixing the airplane. So
you definitely went into a different direction. I thought you were going to talk about this guy.
100%.
It was a character actor that died, and I was like, oh, he's going to talk about this character. So we've gone completely off the rails.
Better not die, because I'm getting in my car to go see him later, I think. I didn't know it was her until looking at IMDb, which I agree with, after watching the movie. I first thought they had just picked up an unknown actress in Dakota while filming, completely unrecognizable from her days as a child star, as she played an almost ghost skin colored character. And I agree, she is unrecognizable. I'm going to move down to the last paragraph. Yeah. Actually, I'm not. I'm going to back this up, and there's a reason why. And I thought of you, Jeff, when this took place, because I know how you feel. Earlier in the day, he picked up a dog on the street and adopted
it. Oh, yes. That was a bad. That was bad.
Yeah. He bought a book on how to care for his dog. He accidentally his shots accidentally land and kill the dog instantly. So if this is the kind of thing you're into, you enjoy this movie. Are people into seeing animals being killed on film? I'm assuming there's got to be people out there. That's insane.
If you're into that, please don't reach out to me, because I don't want to know you. So
yeah, if you're into that, yeah, just keep that shit to yourself. But that was, and I'm glad that Ryan brought that up too, because after he kills the dog and he moves on from killing the dog fairly easy. I think he apologizes and then goes and buries him. But later in the movie, he adopts a goldfish and he's reading a book, How to Care for Your Fish. So I like the fact that he has even the most rudimentary thing. I mean, getting a goldfish is pretty rudimentary. Change the water once in a while and give it a little food. It'll be fine. He's got to read this like voluminous book on how to make this happy. Random thoughts about the movie are there are two scenes where he goes to rent a movie at a Redbox knockoff. Very sly Netflix, showing that the place is in the middle of nowhere. The only place to rent quality movies is the old way. They really should have gone for the gold on this joke, as they really should have just had the place have the last Blockbuster in the world. He could rent a movie. If they wanted to go all in on this joke, it would have been a home run. All in all, when it comes to Netflix original movies, all I can say is they make great television series. So, sounds like Ryan likes some of the things about this, didn't like a lot, and I think at the end he wasn't a huge fan of this movie. Ashley, not a huge fan of this movie. I think Tom liked it a little bit more than everybody else.
A couple things I will say. The actual scene where the dog is killed, it is not – you do not see it. It is it takes place where you see his expression and he realizes what he's done. So I don't want anyone to think that we see a dog being killed. It's more implied. And then, of course, you see him burying the animal afterwards. So anyway, now that we've gone through that slightly depressing, just slightly, Barry, movie of the week. Yeah. Thanks to Barry Rose with the dog killing. Thank you, Barry, for that. Now it's time. Let's be a smooth transition here, Barry. Let's go from the killing of the fucking dog to our special interview for the week. Barry, how cool is it that we reached out to and connected with a guest of the show previously, Bob Roop. Bob, as you know, recently media firestorm as the video of the Knoxville Five has come out, and people have certainly offered their opinions and thoughts on this video and what was said on the video. So Barry and I talked and we decided we'd like to hear from Bob, hear his thoughts. What was going on, the thought process and making this. So now, why don't we go to our interview with Bob Roop? Okay, we are happy to be joined once again by Barry, I believe third time guest at this point. Our friend Bob Roop.
Third time, Jeff.
Third time's a charm. So Bob, how you doing today?
Good, good. Good to be with you again.
So Bob, never ever out of the spotlight, as once again his name popped up on social media and in certain Facebook groups, Twitter accounts, dare I say, as the video of what's being called the Knoxville Five, a video that was made some 40 years ago, and suddenly, Bob, you're relevant again. So we decided to invite Bob to come on. Barry and I wanted to ask you some questions about the particularities of this video, what was going on with you and some of the other guys, if you could answer for them, and just get your general thoughts on what was going on when this video was made when you were in Knoxville in 1979.
Okay, we were the guys you saw there. We had tried to do a hostile takeover of Ron Fuller's wrestling territory, and in the process of doing it, we were in the process of trying to start a reunion for wrestlers.
Let me just interrupt you for a second. For the uninitiated who have not seen the video, why don't you give us the background? First of all, who were the five guys in the video, or the four guys besides yourself, of course, and take it from there. I apologize for interrupting.
Well, that's okay. Do it anytime. Ronnie, myself, Ronnie Garvin, Larry Simon, or Boris Malenko, Bob Orton Jr.,
and Ron Wright.
Ron Wright, yeah. Well, again, we had tried to do a house to take over, and with the idea of starting a union and having a unionizing pro wrestling. And one of the people who had been in our group, Chicken, I don't know what he did, I used the term stooge us off. He went and exposed what we were doing. And the idea of the wrestlers unionizing scared the promoters so bad that Eddie Graham in Florida, even though he was kind of far removed from us, but Barnett in Atlanta, Jim Crockett on our northeast side, and I think it was Jarrett, I'm not sure who it was in Tennessee on our west side, they all collaborated. When we would be doing a show in Knoxville or any big show we had, they would always have run opposition. They'd have 18 guys on a card, Andre the Giant and the world champion, the NWA champion or whatever. And they always had these loaded cards, and so we couldn't compete with them. And we were looking for a way to try to, you know, keep our efforts. We put everything into it to, you know, we knew that we were going to be persona non grata in the business for a while if we failed, but we tried. And so we came up with the idea. It wasn't my idea. It might even been Ron Wright. I don't remember exactly. But the idea was that we were going to try to show these promoters that were ganging up against us, we were going to try to show that we could hurt them. And at that time, you know, it was 10 years earlier than when the WWE had that special where they told everybody that, you know, wrestling is sports entertainment rather than a real sport. So, but in the late 80s, it was still kayfabe. I mean, there were guys that were, you know, they were keeping it from their own families that we were working. And so it was pretty radical stuff. And I watched the video. I was shocked to see it. I had forgotten it existed. And actually, I like the way I looked 40 years ago. I mean,
don't we all?
Yeah. That's the truth. Yes. But
the idea was we were going to do it like not an expose, but we were going to explain the business. And we were talking about, you know, how blood is generated. And we were going to basically get one of the things we were going to get into, I don't know if we mentioned it, but one of the things we were going to get into is how the business was illegal. It was a trust, the wrestling business. So the promoters, they had their yearly meetings, and they agreed to help each other and to discourage any kind of opposition from, outlaw groups or whatever. They would all get together and squash them. And that was illegal. Sherman Antitrust Act outlawed that kind of stuff. So we were going to get into that to where they were going to have legal problems. But we just, we ran out of money, and I don't know, Larry Simon, poor Larry, he had some problems at home, his mother or some family, where he had to go back to Florida. And Bobby needed an income. So we had a chance to go to work with the Papos. Was it ICW, I think, was their,
correct,
was,
yes,
their promotion? Correct. And so once one of us or two of us peel off, we tried some other things to raise money. We did a couple of Tough Man shows. We did three of them, and one of them we did okay. We made some money, but the other two we just broke even. And so that wasn't,
hey Bob,
going
not,
to be.
Not to interrupt you also, but you did one of these shows at Curtis Hickson in Tampa, correct?
We did. That wasn't our show, but we fought in it, yeah.
Okay.
Ronnie and, my, Johnny Bob Orton Jr. and myself, we entered it because that was another way. We had come down there to run a show in opposition to Graham for Ronnie Hill. And we saw this tough man contest going on, and we thought, why don't we enter it? We didn't tell them we were wrestlers, the people who were running it. But I told Ronnie and Bobby, and I said, well, why don't we enter it? Because that's the way we can show why aren't the Florida wrestlers, aren't Mike Graham and the Florida wrestlers, why aren't they entering this?
So you wanted to legitimize your point and your side of the story as being real wrestlers.
Well, no, that wasn't it. We were trying to embarrass them.
Oh, okay.
We were hot. I lost $100,000 in that adventure. I put $100,000 into it I never got back, and my savings. And we tried real hard. We gave it a good fight, but we if we hadn't been compromised by someone, turning spy or turn traitor on us, we would have had a chance. But once they were, I'm telling you, the idea that we were going to unionize scared the crap out of them. And so that was basically what it was about. And we made allusions to things like, again, plan B, C, D, and F or whatever that has conjecture out there that there may be more of this kind of thing. But this was a one-trick pony. That's the only one we did. And again, if you'll notice, we never knocked the fans. We never knocked, you people are stupid for watching wrestling or anything like that, because we never felt that way. The spectators, the people who came to the matches, are the one that paid our bills. But my disappointment has always been with the promoters and the wrestlers themselves, the guys who would not stand up for themselves, would not stand up for the business, that got out and made interviews about how they were going to, and in real life that they were, that guy's a shooter, he's tough or whatever, and wouldn't stand up for themselves. They get, complain in the cars up and down the road, we got cheated in our payoff again, and just take it, not fight, not quit, and protest that you quit and say, well, if you're not going to pay me the way you should, I'm going to quit. And,
Bob, let me ask you a question. I don't mean to interrupt your train of thought there. So, was your, as we look back upon this, was your primary beef with Ron Fuller or was with promoters in general?
In general, I quit a lot of them because they didn't, they didn't pay the way that they should have. Ron, I was his booker and I had a percentage. I was supposed to get 5% of gross. And, the figures didn't match. I don't want to go into detail, but the figures didn't match. We'd be in a house where Ron Wright pulled me aside one night in Harlan, Kentucky, and he said, come here, I want to show you something. And we looked out there, and the house was full. There couldn't get any more people in there. And I saw some things go on at the box office. There was a mother-daughter two people were, one was selling, one was taking tickets. And there was some, let's say, sleight of hand going on. So when, we knew what a sellout was in terms of what the box office gate should be, and yet the figure we got back was like as much as $2,000 less. Now that enabled anybody doing that, I'm not going to be specific here, but let's say allegedly, anybody doing that, you're supposed to pay state tax, and I'm not sure federal, but I know state anyway. And also, you're supposed to pay the buildings a percentage based on the gate. So there's some fraud going on, theft through fraud and outright stealing. But I also was I was having as much as $1,000 a week taken from me. We had that territory going. Ronnie Garvin had already been a booker and up in Canada and places, and Larry Malenko had been around the business for 30, 25 years, and the three of us put our heads together. We lived in the same apartment complex, and we'd get our heads together, and we came up with, all these great ideas. I basically threw out, you know, my stuff, which was so bad that they would come up with something much better. But we had the territory, I mean, really rocking. Ron Fuller wasn't even there. He was down in Pensacola getting his other territory down there in good shape. And we were running it for him. And then, you know, I went to him twice with, you know, with, to tell him, you're being stolen from, or something else is going on, but the house is not right. And he denied it. And so finally, we were running it anyway. Ronnie suggested, why don't we take it? I thought about it, and I thought about the union, because that gave us some power. You know, I mean, not power in terms of, but it gives you some backing. It gives you some strength, your numbers, to have a union behind you. But and the business would be radically different today. I'm not saying the WWE would have been everything they are today. Maybe they'd been even been more. But the business wouldn't have been totally wiped out like it was for a while, where there was hardly any other business. There had been 40 or, 50 NWA promotions around the world, and they were all gone. And so we would have had other businesses, because when the WWE took over everything, there was, I don't know, how many hundreds of workers were put out of the boys were put out of work. They would have been available to, you know, to work. And you could have had, you know, you could have gotten two or three territories going if you had the union, because you had the union to help, you know, to keep you, to keep saved even the WWE, if they weren't unionized, which they wouldn't be, of course, to keep them from coming in and you know, trying to kill your business by running opposition to you. You could, so you would have some power that way. The business would be completely different. I always wanted to say the Strader, he screwed around a lot of people. It wasn't just us. He screwed around a lot of people. I mean, we had evidence of pro football, pro baseball, pro basketball. Those guys went off from being just like us, just getting absolutely reamed, to all of a sudden becoming millionaires. Guys were getting, you know, there were guys, rookies starting out with more than Mickey Mantle made in his entire year sometimes. Was their first year was after a union of only baseball being unionized only 2 or 3 years. So, you know, but the guys, again, I love the boys, and but we're our own worst enemies sometimes.
So I want to go back to something I'm sorry. I wanted to go back to something that you said earlier in this conversation as well. So you were talking about one of the boys stooging you off to Eddie Graham as far as unionization, but he was with you initially. So was the Knoxville 5 actually the Knoxville 6 in the beginning?
Yeah, it was. And the guy who did it has passed on, so I can't say anything. But, you know, if you could, you're a historian, you probably know who it is. You could figure it out. But
yeah,
I can't.
I say his name? Is it okay if I bring up his name?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. It was Dick Slater, correct?
Is it okay if I don't react? If you're right. Wait a minute. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Nod your head once if it was him. Nod your head twice if it wasn't. So,
there you
Bob, you said that once. Is that what you said? Okay.
Let me ask you a question that's come up from some different places, like I said, Facebook, Twitter, is previous to this, you had been involved with Roy Shire in San Francisco. So and you had some problems with Shire, with you felt that he had kind of shorted you on some payoffs and stuff like that. So compare what happened in Knoxville with what had happened to you previously in San Francisco. Was it a similar feeling that you were being somehow the promoter was kind of taking advantage of the boys?
Well, Roy had tremendous heat with the boys because he was, you wouldn't believe it. He would call guys and us, I mean, he'd say the words, SOB and MF and all that to their face. They come back after a match. The first time I walked in, he's cussing out Lonnie Mane. Great big, but Lonnie Mane, Roy coming up to about his, you know, belt buckle. And, and Roy screaming at him, "You stupid, blah, 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 blah," and all that. And I looked at him like, I thought it was a rib, but he talked that way, the guy. So through some different things that happened, he was having a problem with Pat Patterson, should have been a booker, but he was trying to get Pat to perjure himself in court. So Pat wasn't going to do it, and so Roy tried to blackmail him by making me the booker, thinking I was just going to carry a tape recorder with his finishes on it, but I took control of it, and we got business going again. Roy had been using the same material. He was doing watching the same movie with different actors for 20 years. It's not any good anymore, even if you change the actor. So what happened out there was the promoters, all his auxiliary promoters, Louis, somebody in Sacramento, and I'm sorry, Louis, if you're still around, sorry, I forgot your name, but his associate promoters came to me and said, we ain't working with this guy. Why don't you try to take it? I'm pretty sure you can get the TV. And so, I had to talk to the guys, and I made a mistake. There was a tag team out there, and one of the guys was good friend of mine, the other one I didn't know at all. So he got included, and he told Roy, and I came back from, being gone for a day or two, and Roy called me in his office and fired me because, the guy had come to him and said I was going opposition, which is true. But it wasn't because Roy didn't pay. Roy didn't pay too bad. His pay was okay, but he paid you a week behind. In other words, he always owed you a week, maybe even 2 weeks of pay, so that, that would keep guys from running out on him, which that part of it was smart enough. But many times when guys would leave and go back across the country, like say back to Florida from California, that last week of pay never made it to you.
And, so let me ask you, other than that, you talked about the verbal abuse with Shire and stuff. So from a treatment of the talent, was Ron Fuller wasn't anything like Roy Shire? And I'm not talking about the payoffs. I'm talking about strictly one-on-one, the way he treated the boys when he was there.
Oh, no, he was one of the boys. Okay. Ron was a good
guy. So you didn't have a personal problem with Ron. That's what I'm getting at.
Well, let's put it this way. I don't feel like he was being frank with me. And I don't want to say any words starting with L, but, I don't feel like he was telling me the truth. And, it's pretty, very obvious. I understand body language, and there's certain body things people do when they're telling untruths. And I went to him twice. I tried to level with him. He wouldn't level with me. He might have been able to keep me. I was just going to leave. He might have been able to keep me. I might have gone along with it if I said, "Well, okay, Ron, it's a $10,000 house. You pay, say, 30%. Let's say that's the deal. You could call the house whatever you want. You can say it's $5,000, but for whoever you might be wanting to have to report that figure to, but pay me on the 10 and the guys. See, I was paying the guys every night. Pay. So I was in the middle. We got paid in cash every night. So I said, well, pay the $3,000, whatever the house really is. If he'd have proposed that kind of deal, I might have gone along with it. I would have made myself a criminal co-conspirator and stuck through fraud, but I could always claim I didn't know. But I might have stayed. I love Knoxville. That's why we wanted to take it. Short trips, I went back to Ronnie and Larry. I said, look, I'm going to give my notice and leave. You can only get screwed if you allow yourself to. I said, there's plenty of places I can go work anywhere. I said, I'll do it. And Ronnie said, man, don't do that. He said, come on, let's take this place. And, he loved it too. He wanted to stay there too. We could see staying there forever. And, but the way to do that, we knew everybody was going to come after us. So we needed to get the union and get a TV. And we were working on both. And by getting ratted on, I sound like I don't want to use that word, but by being compromised, and I don't want to like use the word exposed, because that sounds like you're doing something wrong. We were doing something right. I mean, I look back, I don't have any difficulties about doing that, except there's some ways now would be a smarter way to do it. But, you don't tell more than one or two people what you're doing, because, if there's even two people knowing what you're doing, it's not a secret anymore. So, Ron was pleasant, and I'm sure he still is. He was a pleasant enough guy. But the Russian business was, you talk about a license to steal. I ran box offices for a while when I was working. It was Ole Anderson's a booker working for the land out of Atlanta after Turner bought it. And one of the box office people that took a shine to me, I would go settle with the box offices at the shows. One of the box office people that, so I don't know, I knew him somehow personally, told me there's 72 ways you can cheat on selling tickets in the box office. 72. And I'm sure most of the promoters that were, running their own buildings and had their own people there probably knew 75. So, one of the first jobs I ever had in the business, it's funny, they sent me down to Miami to click the house. I stood out in the lobby kind of unobtrusively where I could see people coming in, and I had a clicker in my hand. I was clicking because they had a deal going with Chris Dundee down there, who was the promoter, that he was allegedly double selling tickets. And because, so they didn't, they would, so the house being listed at 20 grand, they'd say it was 15 or 10 or whatever. And they were, because they were worried about Chris stealing from them too. You hire a thief, what do you expect? And so I was clicking the house to see if the thief was being honest, which is, that's irony. That's what I'm laughing about.
You
that's
can't funny. Trust the thief, Bob. I mean, come on.
Well, if he's your thief, maybe you can. I don't know. I keep my valuables locked up though, and have button flaps on my pockets. Ron was fine personally, and I wish him well. We all pay for what we do in life. I mean, I don't know. So maybe some people get away with it, but who knows? They have to live with themselves.
Yeah, so it's funny. I reached out to some people this week, and one of the people I reached out to was Scott Teal, and Scott said he had actually seen this video some 20 years ago, and he said it was on the back of a VHS videotape, and he saw it, and he said it was, it was a little surprising, but it didn't make this gigantic impact on him. But there was all these theories that went out this week. And when something like this is released, that within the territorial wrestling world, it becomes controversial. And somebody came up with this and stated this as fact. And I wanted to run this by you and see, A, if this was accurate. And if not, maybe you can take it line by line and tell me exactly where it goes. But it's this in relation to the video. It was never going to be released. Never, ever. It was a bluff. They were trying to get Crockett to step in and help them out of the mess that they had gotten into. This was shot in the middle of the night at WKPT Studios in Kingsport, Tennessee, by Fred Phelan. There is a second part that was also shot at Fred's home.
About the middle of the night, that part sounds right. I don't know where the studio, but that's possible. I know nothing about Crockett. We did it in Tennessee, up where Ron Wright lived. It seemed to me he was the one that came up with this idea. Now, maybe he had this going. Ron might have had that going without telling the rest of us, or me anyway, about it. I don't know why he wouldn't. We were kind of all in it together. All Ron was going to do okay. He lived up there anyway, and if he didn't work for a while, he still was going to be okay. Somebody else would hire him, and he could work other places besides. He wasn't really with us in our opposition, but he wasn't one of the plotters, so to speak. But the name of the person who shot it, The idea that it was never going to be released, but we never would have made it. We never would have made it if it wasn't going to be released. Why would you make it? The idea was to somehow screen it for promoters. And maybe that was, now I don't know this. This is just conjecture on my own to myself. Maybe Ron, or through Ron, somebody he knew, might have had a connection to show this thing to Crockett. That might have been, because how do you approach the promoters? You mail it to them anonymously, or you put, you know, you weren't going to put, I mean, back in those days, you couldn't put it on the air and just, you know, like, run it because, you know, everybody, you heard everybody's business, you know, all the boys that hate you for, excuse me, you know, you would say some of the things I said, you say, well, would you care? Well, I didn't want to hurt guys. And, you know, I mean, there are a lot of great guys in the business. Not everybody was just, you know, was a backstabber. And, you know, I beefed about guys complaining and not doing anything about it. Well, not everybody does that. Probably the other jobs, people don't like to think they need raises, or money has a way of drawing out, you know, unhappiness. But I didn't want to alienate all the wrestlers, you know, or show such lack of respect that I would be hurting everybody's income. Because they were back in the late 80s, it was still kayfabe. I don't know if CAC was in business yet, but there weren't these reunions going on. I mean, in those days when an old-timer retired, it was usually, you know, if he lived long, it was because they'd retired, they had nothing but a beat-up body. Most of the guys didn't save their money. And, you know, I used to see old wrestlers that I'd seen in their prime. I saw them years later kind of hanging around on the fringes. And in most cases, it was sad. They looked old and tired and beat up. And, you know, it was sad because, you know, they had their moment in the sunlight, and it shouldn't, you know, turn out that way, that when you go out to pasture, that's when if you're talking about a racehorse, that's when you get to eat the grass without having to go out and train every day, you know, and be in stud, or, you know, or at least, you know, frolic around and rest and relax and be happy and not just be miserable. Now, a lot of the guys brought it on themselves because they missed being famous. You know, they didn't like going back to being who they really were. But that's a different problem.
Bob, let me ask you a question that our producer Lou Kippelman has put forward. I'm going to read you his question, what he wrote. When Bob talks about unionizing, the government's consent decree with the NWA went into effect in 1956, largely due to Sam Muchnick's political connections. By 1979, Muchnick was a couple of years away from retirement, and the NWA territories were softening or going out of business altogether. Detroit, Los Angeles, San Francisco. Do you think the time was right to buck the establishment? And if so, did you have the path to leverage any political connections to make those changes?
Well, you know, the consent decree is news to me. I think what does that mean? That, okay, we're going to agree that you're not a trust? I think we did have access. Ronnie had a lawyer. He had a high-powered lawyer that was, I don't know if he was a fan or he knew him somehow. Ronnie was really over. Ronnie and Knoxville was a much smaller territory, but Ronnie was like Dusty and JYD out in Mid-South in Knoxville. He was over. I mean, he was really strong there, and he was a baby face. He was over like $1 million. And he had plus Ronnie's a good guy, very gregarious, just a hammer, a likable guy. He's very likable. And he had a lawyer friend. I mean, we had a couple of beefs that the cops just, and Knoxville police just didn't like us. That they kind of ran us up, you know. One of them arrested my wife. She had to spend the night in jail just because she drove by some cones in the road that you couldn't hardly see. And she wasn't drinking or anything. I had been the one drinking. That's why she was driving. Well, they arrested her. She had to go to court. Well, we had this lawyer come in, Ronnie, and the guy stepped in front of the judge. The judge said, like, 3 seconds. I'm serious. guy stepped in front of the judge. I don't know if he just said hello, but the judge wrapped his gavel and said dismissed. And so he was high-powered. And we had him on our side, and he wasn't going to charge us an arm and a leg. He liked the boys. He liked. I remember talking to him about the unionizing. So, yes, we did have some clout. And I am not conversant with the extent of his connections. But I referred to it, like 2 hours ago to you guys, but 10, 20 minutes ago, I said there were things, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, and you're supposed to get older and wiser. There were things I would have done different. I would have had political, some kind of backing, some sort of political clout, maybe a lawsuit prepared in advance to put him on a defensive, you know, antitrust or whatever, to leave us alone. But, you know, we weren't thinking, and like I said, I was going to leave, and then there was any chance of us doing it would be gone. So we were kind of, you know, we only had about, I think, 2 weeks before, Ron called me, and he fired me. He said, well, I heard your, Eddie Graham told me you're going opposition, and so I denied it. You know, I felt like, I had to protect the guy. I didn't want anybody else to be. I had to go, but that didn't mean that Ronnie and Bobby and Larry had to go. So I denied it to protect them. And then we, you know, when I told the guys we'd been compromised, they said, well, let's go anyway. And, but we couldn't get TV, and then, like I say, the all the promoters around us came in against us. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, so when I first saw the video, I guess the first thing that struck me is a kind of a two-part question. The first thing that struck me is if this tape had gotten out back then, okay, and say Eddie Graham, I'm just going to use the name of a promoter that you work with on a regular basis. If Eddie Graham had gotten a copy of this tape, okay, do you think I guess my two-part question is, what would have disturbed Eddie more? Would it have been just the breaking kayfabe as you guys did, or the very tail end of the tape when you said, we have planned a second part where we're going to go into things like the homosexuality in the business. We're going to be going into things like how wrestlers bleed. Which part of this whole thing, or the whole possibility of you guys trying to set up a union, what would have been more concerning to a man like Eddie Graham? Or it would have been all of it. I'm sure that's the answer. But which one of these would have been the most concerning to a man like Eddie Graham?
The kayfabe, definitely.
Yeah.
Eddie was so over in Tampa. He was voted 1 year, or however they do it, Tampa Downtown Athletic Club Professional Athlete of the Year. You know, like the year before had been Wade Boggs, and then it had been Dick Butkus. You know, for a professional wrestler to get that award, Professional Athlete of the Year, you got to have some clout. You got to have some respect. Eddie, that's one of the reasons they stretch marks all the time. And I mean, I did a few of them. Hero did a bunch of them. I did, I don't know, a dozen or so. And they advertised them. They say, you want to break into the business, come on down and try out. And then they stretch them and they send them back out in the public, bust it up open, or, you know, something broken, so that it was like a good advertisement. Eddie wanted to try to run the deal that this was all real. You know, having Jack Briscoe and me and Dale Lewis and guys who had amateur backgrounds, Hiro Matsuda, guys that could really, you know, could wrestle for real. That's the wrong term to use. They could do amateur wrestling, pro wrestling, and headlocks for real in pro wrestling, drop kicks for real in pro wrestling. But, you know, you say shoot, submission or whatever holds. That would give it an air of more legitimacy. But you and I, guys, we all know those kind of matches, those shoots are so boring. wrestling fans, you know, you have two people in your house after about 3 weeks of that because it's boring. I went to the finals of the Olympics in Munich. It's a 10,000-seat house. It wasn't full. And that's the Olympics, the final round. So, because amateur wrestling is not theatrical like pro wrestling, it doesn't have the bathos and pathos of the good against evil good against bad sort of soap opera type mystique to it. So Eddie would have hated that. The homosexual was probably, there was a promoter, I think we all know who it is, so I don't want to harm anybody's relatives. But, and then the Blade, that was for everybody. The Blade, to me, it's not shocking to me. The idea that you had blood capsules or, that stuff, I don't know, maybe somebody did one time, I don't know. And there was a way of filling a balloon. I don't know if I should say this on the air, but guys were going to, there was the one where if you were going to, like, hit in the throat or you, for whatever reason, say you were going to, you got bit by a werewolf and you were going to, you know, be hydrophobic on television, you'd have Alka-Seltzer in your mouth. And, and when the time was right, you'd, saliva it up a little and you're foaming at the mouth. Well, there's a way to get blood out of your mouth, too. And you weren't going to use a razor blade, but guys would fill a bologna or a prophylactic with their own blood and have it in their cheek like a chaw of tobacco. And, there were certain techniques. Maybe that's where the blood capsule came from, because people were trying to figure out, well, how the hell do they, that's got to be, after all these years, something new. That's what they were talking about with the blood capsule, was when the blood out of the mouth. Because why would you use a blood capsule? Oh, maybe they thought that when guys reached up to their forehead, they were taking a blood capsule and squeezing it to run the blood down on over their face. Maybe that's what they're thinking. I never understood what, I thought for me the blood capsule was the stupidest thing in the world. I'm glad that McMahon did what he did. In a way, after our tape came out, I'm glad he did what he did, because I'll tell you, for 5 seconds after I saw that thing, I went, oh my God. We exposed the business on that one. And then I remembered. I said, oh, yeah. I've already been exposed for 20, 30 years now. One thing, I get off the subject a little. One of the things about exposing the business is that it makes it very dangerous for heels, because there have been people who got divorced over pro wrestling things, where families, doesn't happen often, but it does happen, where families, hurt each other, arguing over pro wrestling things. And when they find, because they, they really believed it. Some people are not very sophisticated and, or maybe they're young or whatever. And there were injuries done based on pro wrestling. When they find out it was all staged, that makes it dangerous for the heels.
Sometimes there are divorces because the wife thinks that the husband spends a little much too much time watching pro wrestling. But I digress. I'm not talking about anyone we would know here.
Jeff, I think it's somebody that we both know extremely well, Jeff. But hey, this has been unbelievable. I know that we are coming to our max on time right now. We don't want to get the great Brian Last too upset by going over 2 hours. Bob, we don't want to have to cut this short. Would you be willing to join us for a part two next week as well?
Of course. I mean, that's a very flattering, guys. And I apologize if I am too long-winded. I get into stream of consciousness sometime, and I don't know, sometimes that might be the best, because it's not a pattern, it's not a script of any kind, it's just, sharing my thoughts with you. And I tell you, I want to thank all of you so much for let me express myself like this, because, you know, that's what keeps us alive, is being able to do that.
Well, Bob, we're going to give you another opportunity next week. I know that people will want to hear. This is way too fascinating. But before we go, I just want to give a quick plug. Bob, you have an appearance coming up in the Northeast, which I think is your first Northeast appearance maybe ever, because I can't think of you being up here previously, but it is Mark Out at the Meadowlands, coming to the Meadowlands Plaza Hotel on Sunday, April the 7th, 2019, with a 10 a.m. start time. It's just a mere few hours before WrestleMania begins. Joining Bob, and Bob, I'm going to be there, so I'm real excited to see you again. Jim Ross, good old JR, will be there. Tully Blanchard, Stan Hansen, Tito Santana, Butch Reed, Danny Spivey, Scott Casey, King Kong Bundy, Brutus the Barber Beefcake, the Tonga Kid, Bill Raptor, Terry Runnels, Greg the Hammer Valentine, and many other names. This is an absolutely huge event. And if you want to hear some of these stories, you know, Bob Roop is going to be there. As I mentioned, I'll be there. I want to hear Bob tell some of these stories in person. I encourage everybody. You can get tickets at www.mattmcon.com. That's www.mattmcon.com. You can also visit our Facebook page, which is Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. We'll have a link there to be able to purchase tickets. You definitely do not want to miss this event.
So, Bob, we want to take a second and just thank you for joining us here on this interview, and to explain your thoughts, what was going through your mind as you were making the tape of the Knoxville Five. And, Bob, we certainly, again, appreciate your appearance and in discussing this.
Well, the pleasure's mine. Thank you, guys. And, again, I appreciate it a lot, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Okay. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, guys.
So, Barry, I think you'll agree that part one of our interview with Bob Roop was pretty good stuff, huh?
Oh, you know, it's an education. I sit here and I absorb all this, and I love hearing about the history of what went down in professional wrestling before the days of kayfabe being shattered. You know, we really weren't, privy to this stuff. So to be able to hear it, to me, super exciting.
Well, what I thought was kind of interesting was we originally were planning on going only for one segment, but as Bob began telling his stories, we decided to make it into a two-part story, a two-part episode. So what we decided was that we were going to leave you with the first question that I asked Bob, which was this. So let me give you just a speculative question, Bob. You're at the Mark Out at the Meadowlands, and you round a corner. And not that he's scheduled to be there, I don't believe, but as you turn the corner, you look up, and there's Ron Fuller right in front of you. So you're going to go up, you're going to shake his hand, you're going to kayfabe that you see him. How's that going to work out? What do you think? So now, as we get ready to close out the show, Barry, we have told the folks that we're going to be continuing the top 25, not top 10, the top 25 CW Fangles of all time. Barry, what are we going to be offering up for the folks next week?
It is, in my opinion, it is the most controversial angle in the history of championship wrestling from Florida. And I would say prior to the national expansion, or I guess this angle took place in 85, which was really kind of in the early stages of the national expansion. It's one of the most controversial angles in professional wrestling. It is the Freebird heel turn on Mike Graham from 1985. And this was done shortly after the suicide death of Mike's father, Eddie Graham. I remember seeing this when it first took place. I remember being completely stunned, and then watching it numerous times in the years following. Jeff, I know you've got a lot of notes on this one, but we are going to delve deep into this next week.
They said things about my father that I'll never let stand. That's the one line from that angle that I always remember. So, okay, folks, we appreciate you joining us here on Breaking Kayfabe. You can follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Special thanks and shout out to our man, Sweet Lou Kippelman, on the production duties. Until next week, Freebirds next week.